I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to The Connection. Philosopher Stephen Cave says that we humans struggle with something he calls the mortality paradox. We know that death is inevitable, and yet we cannot conceive of not existing. What we do instead is make up stories that help us live with this existential conundrum. These narratives include the search for the fountain of youth, beliefs in resurrection, rebirth, and the immortality of the soul, and the value of our legacy, what we leave behind. While our lifespans have increased dramatically in the last century thanks to science and medicine, the longevity industry is promising to defy aging and even death itself. So how would living to 150 and beyond change what it means to be alive? How does our mortality make life more precious and meaningful? Is aging an illness that needs to be cured? How can we deal with our fear of death? These are heady questions indeed. Well, joining us is Stephen Cave. He's a professor at Cambridge University, director of the Leeuwenhoek Center for the Future of Intelligence, wrote a book a number of years ago called Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization, and co-author of a newer book, Should You Choose to Live Forever? Stephen Cave, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Hello, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I did a little bit of research about longevity here in the United States. If you and I were born in 1900 in the United States, we could expect to live to be 46 years old if we were a man, 48 years old if we were a woman. Today, it's closer to 80, of course, with obvious differences for sex and race and income. Help us understand what, I guess, science and medicine have done to increase our lifespans.
Hmm. Yeah, absolutely. This is really one of the greatest revolutions in human history, that over about 100 years in developed countries, life expectancy has doubled. So you mentioned it was between, you know, in the 40s, close to 50, in around 1900. Before that, it would have been, you know, late 30s, around 40. And now, as you say, it's 80. Life expectancy has doubled. It's an incredible achievement. And it's an achievement that's come from understanding the nature of disease, so that, you know, it's borne by germs and so on, bacteria and viruses, and the kind of public health measures. You know, we no longer have open sewers in our streets and so on. Doctors wash their hands. And of course, we have much better health services and so on. Now, but it is a misconception to think that most people just, you know, lived until they were in their 30s or 40s and then dropped dead.
Sure.
Because the vast majority of people dying were babies and children. So there were still, 100 years ago, plenty of people living to a ripe old age.
Does this increase in lifespan, though, kind of reinforce our belief in ideas about immortality, that it gets us closer to maybe the possibility of living forever? I'm not sure I want to do that. But nonetheless, the fact that we can live so long doesn't make us want to live even longer.
Well, certainly it's incredibly inspiring. So these are huge achievements that are allowing us to live so much longer. Achievements in engineering and science and technology and medicine, of course. And so the real optimists are saying, well, if we've doubled life expectancy once, maybe we can do it again. And again, you know, now we've worked out that there isn't some mysterious animating spirit, but, you know, essentially we are machines that can be repaired, biological machines, then maybe we can keep being repaired indefinitely. So this is a very inspiring story for those who do want to keep living longer.
Well, indeed, and I do want to get to that, but just to underscore what you said, I mean, thinking about transplants or artificial limbs or robots or AI, I mean, one can feel ourselves sort of moving into the future as we're living now.
Yeah. I mean, it will be much more difficult to see the kind of increases we've seen in the last 150 years, just because it's much easier to add years to the life of a baby. So if you stop someone dying at the, you know, at the age of 6 months, then you can hope nature will take its course and they'll live to a ripe old age. It's much harder to add extra years to someone in their 80s and so on. But it is possible, and we are seeing that. Now, it's not evenly spread, as you mentioned. Different demographics benefit to different extents from new technology. And many people believe we are on the verge of new breakthroughs. You know, we live in an age of genetic engineering and nanotechnology and, of course, AI.
Would you like to live to 120 or 150? Is that something that you've thought about or imagined what your life would be like?
I do imagine, as someone who thinks a lot about the future of technology, then I'm very curious. I'd love to know what the world is like 150 years from now. As someone with children, I'm keen to see them grow up and maybe have children of their own and so on. So I certainly don't feel tired of life now. Whether I will become tired of life or whether the world will change around me in ways that make it seem much less attractive, that's much harder to say.
I have to say, as someone in my 70s, and I frankly think a lot more about death than I did when I was in my 40s, obviously what's ahead is a lot shorter than what is behind. And I find myself sort of caught between not wanting to die for all the obvious reasons, but also not wanting to live forever. And I don't know what that sweet spot is between those two poles.
Yeah, and it might vary for different people, but it's very common that if people are asked if they want to live forever, they say, no, that sounds terrible, it would be boring, and so on. Well, but okay, do you want to die today or tomorrow? And they say no.
Of course not.
Well, if you never die today, you end up living forever. Maybe there is a sweet spot, maybe, you know, 150 or 200 or 1,000, where people have feel they've had a good innings, as we say in England, as a cricket metaphor, but, you know, had a good life, and it's time to move on.
I mean, I think part of getting older is feeling more vulnerable, hopefully feeling, you know, the bitter sweetness of life, sort of knowing that there is going to be an end at some point, hopefully not today and hopefully not tomorrow, but at some point, sort of imagining, so how is it that I want to die or we want to die?
Well, as I say, it's as a rule, we consider it dysfunctional if someone wants to die now.
Right.
We call that depression, and we think it should be treated. So, yes, people can accept their own mortality, particularly as they're getting older, and reconcile themselves to the fact that their time is limited, and that can in all sorts of ways be inspiring. But we hope still that their life has enough quality that they do want to keep going, even while accepting that there'll be a limit to how long they can keep going. And certainly at the moment, as I say, if someone wanted to die now, today, we would think, you know, that was a diagnosable disease, that something had gone wrong in their life experience.
It is interesting, though, to think about the right to die movement. And there are people who were saying, I want to have greater control over my death and how I die, versus the I don't want to die movement. I don't know how big either of those movements are, but it's interesting to feel as if there might be some kind of collision course. And I also think it's about control, that we want to control things that obviously we have limited or maybe no control over.
I think that's exactly right. And that's exactly what both movements have in common. You know, those who want to, who believe we can use, you know, technology, medicine, interventions, jogging, etc., whatever it might be, to ward off the reaper, are trying to take control of this most existential and uncertain part of our lives, the inevitability of death. And so are those who are saying, well, I want to be able to choose. Well, when I die, if it gets too much and so on. And I think that's, I think both are completely understandable. I think the first one, ultimately, it's a fantasy that we can ward off the reaper forever, but that doesn't mean we can't live longer and live better and improve the quality of our lives. The second, of course, is not a fantasy. There are states in the US, in Europe, that do allow people to choose the time of their death under very strict conditions, of course. I think that's welcome and important, but only if it is in conjunction with movements that help us to reconcile ourselves to uncertainty as well, and make the dying experience less terrifying. So I'm talking specifically about the hospice movement. And of course, I'm sure you know, when people advocate for physician-assisted dying and so on, taking control of one's own death, they worry that will come at the expense of the hospice movement, which is about making people's last days, weeks, months as comfortable as possible. And the hospice movement is so important because it really is about embracing the inevitability of death and making the most of it and of those last days and taking the terror away And it feels like a lot of the impetus for the physician-assisted dying movement comes from that place of fear.
I've been with people who have been in hospice, who have died, family members who have died, and it is such a moving experience. Mm. It's also sort of shocking to see life leave someone's body, and you do see that last breath. You see that. You see what how life goes, disappears, is gone.
Yes, and in the right conditions, it can be peaceful. And people who have had near-death experiences come back also and often report that it felt peaceful. And I think the more people understand that and the more that we can create the conditions for that kind of good death, then the more some of the fear that drives the need to control will be removed.
Why do you think we use euphemisms for death? You know, I actually Googled, there are like thousands of them instead of saying the word dead or death. I mean, pass away, at rest, it goes on and on and on. What is that about? What are we doing when we don't use that word?
Well, I believe that every society tells itself stories about how death isn't inevitable or isn't what it seems. Now, that might be that we all have an immortal soul or that we're all going to be resurrected on the day of judgment. Now, if you believe those things, then you can talk openly about death because you don't think death is the end.
Right.
Now, in an increasingly secular society, death is the ultimate end. And in a society that celebrates the individual, that celebrates the self, then it can seem like the devastating, you know, kind of personal apocalypse, the end of everything we've been striving for in cultivating ourselves and cultivating our individuality and so on. So it's a kind of final insult. And so we like to tell ourselves in modern developed societies stories about how we can postpone death, how we can put it off, how if we, you know, with the right diets and exercise regimes and medical care and so on. So we don't like death intruding on our lives. So we deny its reality, partly by just not talking about it.
And deny its reality, even though, and I do want to pick up on this after this very short break that is coming up, and this is this mortality paradox that you write about, and I do want to pick up on that, the idea that we know the future, you know, we know deep inside that we're going to die, and yet we cannot imagine the world without us.
Mm. Exactly. And that's part of what makes us human and defines the human experience.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stephen Cave is our guest on the show. He's a professor of philosophy at Cambridge University. He's written a couple of books about immortality and mortality, I guess. It's hard to not talk about both. Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization, and co-author of a book called Should You Choose to Live Forever? And that's what we're talking about today on The Connection. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news. It can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about the fact that human beings have been searching for the keys to immortality for thousands of years. Probably most of human history obviously have come up short. And again, our guest is philosopher Stephen Cave. Stephen, let me just pick up on this mortality paradox, which I find really fascinating and provocative. This idea that we know we're going to die, and yet we can't imagine it. It is both inevitable and unimaginable, to use your words. This is unique to human beings, right? Because we have a self. We can think into the future. It's unique to what it is to be a human.
Yes. It starts with what we have in common with all living things, but it becomes the mortality paradox because of these huge oversized brains that we have. So it starts with our will to live. All living things around us have this will to project themselves into the future. And if they didn't, they wouldn't exist, right? You know, the mouse that doesn't care about wandering about at night when the owls are prowling gets eaten and doesn't pass on its genes. So every living thing around us has this will to live, to perpetuate itself and to reproduce. And we are the same. But we also have these massive brains that have allowed us to thrive because we can see ourselves as individuals and can cooperate with each other. We have an idea of the future. We can plan all of these incredibly useful things, which, you know, our civilization has been built with. But these brains also have other, more difficult messages for us. When we see our colleagues and comrades are being killed by, you know, lions or villagers from next door or sickness or what have you, then of course we realize that we too will die. One of the oldest work of literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh, is about this. You know, a king has his best friend dies, and first he's mourning his friend, and then it dawns on him, oh my God, does that mean I'm going to die too? And this is a story about, you know, human self-awareness developing. If you like, the Garden of Eden story is about this. It's, you know, that they eat from the tree of knowledge, and part of their punishment is mortality. In other words, with self-awareness, with self-knowledge, comes the realization we're going to die. So we have this powerful will to live that all living things do. But unlike other living things, we have to cope with the knowledge that this will to live will be thwarted, that all of these efforts will come to naught.
I ran across a quote by Sigmund Freud, "At bottom, no one believes in his own death." You agree?
Right. So on the, here I am saying, we're all uniquely, as a species, uniquely aware of our own death. And then Freud comes and says, but hang on, none of us really
right.
believe it.
Exactly.
Well, why is that? And that is because we cannot imagine death. Like, as imagining conscious beings, whenever we try to imagine death, we conjure ourselves like genies into the picture. We can imagine floating in a void or looking down at our own funeral, but we can't truly imagine non-existence. And so Freud says, well, okay, we do recognize the fact of mortality, but at the same time, we can't take it seriously. We can't deeply believe it. There was an English poet many hundred years ago said, all men think all men mortal but themselves.
Yeah.
So we recognize the truth of mortality, but we can't really accept the truth of our own mortality.
How old were you, or was there a certain experience for you where you began to have an inkling of your own mortality?
Yes, I suppose, well, my Gilgamesh moment, if you remember, I mentioned the Epic of Gilgamesh, and he realized he was mortal when his friend died. For me, that was when my grandfathers died. They died within about a year of each other, so I was 4 or 5 when that happened, which is the age when most people are also starting to ask these kind of questions. And it might be because of the experience of a relative or a pet, you know, the pet goldfish, or just as their brains and sense of self and the future grows, that's when they realize. And it starts with mourning, starts with being very sad for the loss of the other, and then this slow realization, like, oh my God, could that happen to me?
You mentioned pets, and I was thinking of, especially cats, or especially thinking of dogs, because it was really, I remember the death of childhood dog that, again, sort of got me thinking like, oh, you know, things don't live forever. Maybe I won't live forever. But I find it interesting with pets is that, you know, the average dog lives maybe 10 or 12 years. We invite them into our lives. We make them our children. We love them. They die. We mourn them. We're heartbroken. And then we do it all over again. Do you think it's a sort of practice of mortality that we live with these little animals?
I mean, it's certainly a way in which many children come to understand the cycle of life. And I think that can be very healthy. Of course, the lesson is always a tough one.
Yeah,
we probably all know what it's like from ourselves or our own children. It can be an extremely tough one. But we are very unusually long-lived creatures. Of course, there are longer-lived creatures, certain kinds of shark, tortoise, and so on. But we are unusually long-lived. And so that means that we see the cycle of life, including loved ones, pets, and so on, playing out in front of us.
What's terror management?
So I mentioned the uniqueness of humans in realizing the inevitability of our own demise, unique as far as we know, of the sort of, you know, millions of species. Maybe there are a couple of other large-brained ones, dolphins, or, who have a similar awareness of mortality. But we're pretty unique. And this is potentially absolutely terrifying, this idea that everything we're striving for is going to collapse, is all for nothing. You know, we will not be able to keep death at bay, no matter how hard we try. And so this is an idea that you can find in philosophy and religion and poetry going back many thousands of years. I would mention Gilgamesh from 5,000 years ago. But very recently, in the 1990s, some psychologists in the US decided to put it to the test. And what they wanted to test is the idea that our worldviews, religions, but also aspects of our politics, help us to deal with the terror of death. So that's why their theory is called terror management theory. It's about managing the terror of death. And so they've done many hundreds of experiments now, but they all have a similar structure. Because you take a group of people, well, two groups of people who are basically the same, and get one group to think about death and the others to think about something unpleasant but not fatal, like mm-hmm. going to the dentist. And then you assess their views and see what happens. And so, you know, for example, you could take two groups of Christians and ask one to reflect on the nature of death, what it'd be like to be dead and so on, ask the other to reflect on loneliness, say, or something. And then ask them again about their beliefs. And what you find is that afterwards, those who were thought about their own death would be twice as likely to express faith in Jesus in the resurrection, for example.
Which gets back to the sort of narratives that you came up with for human beings as we struggle with this notion of our mortality and resurrection, rebirth. You know, and I guess the question is, if we are resurrected, if we're reborn, are we still the same person or are we somebody else? I mean, have we truly come back as ourselves or are we something else?
Yes, exactly. So we tell ourselves stories that help us to manage the terror of death. And it's motivated by a kind of wishful thinking, if you like. That doesn't, I mean, you can wishfully think of something that still might be true, but it's motivated by a kind of wishful thinking. We don't want death to be true. And so in every culture, you can find these stories such as, you know, the resurrection story that's at the heart of Christianity, but also Islam and Orthodox Judaism. The belief in the soul that's incredibly widespread. Many Christians also believe in a soul. Hindus, for example, many, you know, traditional religions. But those views do not always stand up to rigorous philosophical or scientific analysis. I was a philosopher about 100 years ago. I think, I've forgotten the name, forgive me, but he said most people's belief in immortality is strongest when they don't think about it.
So yes,
they don't always
agreed.
And, you know, the resurrection story is a very difficult one. For example, so the Romans used to mock it relentlessly. I mean, you know, the Romans had many accomplished philosophers, and Christianity was spread in the Roman Empire. And at that time, Christianity was very much fixed on physical resurrection, you know, as Jesus had done, and not belief in the soul at all. That came later. And so when the Romans would execute Christians, they would, you know, feed them partly to the lions, then take the remains and then burn them and then spread the ashes in the river and then be like, huh, resurrect that. Well, you know, how do you resurrect that, right? I mean, okay, maybe you put all the molecules together, but then why those molecules? Surely every carbon molecule is identical. Right. And if it doesn't matter which molecules, could God in theory make two of them, but then which one would be the real one?
I can't imagine Romans thinking that way, but yes, I understand exactly what you're saying there, right? Also, the fountain of youth. I mean, this idea that there is this elixir that will let us live forever. That also covers human history.
Absolutely. I mean, resurrection is very much a plan B. You know, if you can get away with not dying in the first place, right, that's even better. And again, it's an incredibly widespread story. I mentioned Gilgamesh, and there we find a story of a kind of herb that grows beneath the sea that will allow people to live forever. And Gilgamesh finds it, but then in the night it's stolen by a snake that goes off shedding its skin, as it does, right? Because, you know, believe that snakes, because we know snakes can't live forever, but it was a sort of common belief. And you find it in every culture. I mean, ancient Egyptians are known for mummification of their mummies. That was a kind of resurrection belief. But actually, they tried very hard not to die in the first place. And, you know, there are ancient papyruses that talk about elixirs of life and so on. And this is a story we are, of course, still telling today. You know, and we started, Marty, today talking about how much scientific and technological progress has resulted in longer lives. And now more people than ever are hoping that, you know, the big breakthrough that will defeat aging and death forever is imminent.
Let me just do the fourth narrative that you write about, which is legacy, the things that we leave behind, in a sense, allow us to think that we're going to live forever, whether they're children or a book that we might have written or something that we might have done, that's how we live on.
This is also a very widespread and influential immortality story. And, you know, with three children and a number of books to my name, I can't say that I'm entirely immune to its seductions. Right. But there are many people who have, you know, given their real life, their biological life, for the sake of this kind of legacy. You know, perhaps most famously, Achilles, the great Greek hero who, on the beach outside the city of Troy, where he was laying siege, was told that he could go home and live a long life as a king of a minor kingdom, you know, happily siring children, or he could stay and fight in Troy, and he would die. It was prophesied by his mum, who happened to be a goddess. He would die and yet become the famous, most famous warrior of all time. And of course, he chose the latter, and here we are 3,000 years later still talking about him. So, you know, but did he make
might
the right
true.
Choice? Is that it might be true, but you know, but is it really immortality? You know, is
Indeed. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Stephen Cave. And yes, we are talking about immortality. So of all of the four things that you just described, is there one that gives you more comfort? As you mentioned, you have children, you've written books. I mean, does legacy feel like immortality? I mean, I often think it's how maybe we're remembered. And over time, obviously, we will not be remembered, but at least among children or grandchildren, maybe great-grandchildren, we will live on in their memories.
Yeah. I think the legacy narrative has the most wisdom in it. That is, you know, people go to extreme lengths, make extreme sacrifices like Achilles for the sake of a kind of immortality that isn't real. But actually, the idea of doing something that resonates through the ages, that helps our children or our grandchildren, or causes that we believe in, contributing in that way, it might not be, it's not real immortality in a sense, it's not really survival, but I think it helps us to come to terms with death, because it makes us focus much less on ourselves and on a much greater picture that, of course, does survive.
What is then the downside of immortality? I mean, if we were able to live forever, what would make it difficult? What would we be struggling with?
Well, first of all, the belief in immortality, which remains extremely widespread. I mean, the vast majority of people on the planet currently do think they're immortal one way or another. The belief in immortality risks undermining the sense of the preciousness of the days that we do have. And you know, this is a wisdom tradition we can find around the world, including in the Bible. You can see it in Ecclesiastes and the Psalms. Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. So, you know, it's important. And Marty, you were talking earlier about, you know, as you have gotten older and thought more about how limited the time you have left is, then it causes you to, you know, reevaluate and prioritize and so on. So I think awareness of mortality, taking seriously mortality, can be important for living the best life, making the best use of the time we have. But say we were immortal, then, you know, wouldn't that be great?
Maybe.
There are fun.
Yeah, I'm on the fence, but yes.
I mean, well, no one comes back to tell us, you know, if they are in the underworld or wherever they might be. So we don't know whether problems that like boredom and meaninglessness and so on that philosophers and poets have speculated about for a long time, we don't know how real they are or when they would kick in. But it is something that philosophers and poets have long worried about, that, you know, if you end up living the same old life for centuries, it would inevitably get terribly dull. Or worse, if you end up living not just the same old life, but 1,000 different kinds of lives, then ultimately meaning breaks down, you don't know good from evil, you don't know who you are anymore, and so on. And in those cases, mortality is a blessing.
Yeah. I mean, I think of time, obviously, if you're immortal, time is, there is no time, right? And how much time defines what we do as mortal beings, whether we think about it or act in response to it.
Exactly. The choices we make in our 70 years and 10 and, you know, our 70 or 80 years really matter. Do we choose to become, you know, a journalist or a philosopher, or, you know, to fight injustice, or, you know, to serve the public in some way, or have children? All of these choices, they define who we are. And if we're living for 1,000, 10,000, a million years or forever, then could we go through all of these? At least there's a wonderful short story written by the Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges, in which he posits this idea that that all men become identical because everyone has done everything, and therefore meaning inevitably breaks down. We don't have any identity and everything becomes pointless. Now, I mean, on the one hand, that's a speculation. We don't know if that would happen. But at the same time, we do know that people are living longer and, you know, the world is more prosperous. And yet 5% of the world's population suffer from depression, you know, and hundreds of thousands of people commit suicide around the world. So, you know, we're already failing in some way, like purpose and meaning in life is already not evenly distributed.
Nearly up in a break here, which is an interesting thing about quality of life versus quantity of life. I mean, that they're often two very different things. The fact that you can live a long life, but can you live a good life and one that makes you feel like you've been a good person and had some kind of good effect on the world?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you just think back over the last few hundred years, you know, what would it have meant to have been, you know, a good Englishman? Right? I'm an Englishman, right? To be a good Englishman. Well, a few hundred years ago, you know, a ruthless patriarch enforcing discipline on my wife and children, serving the empire by bringing my idea of civilization to lots of people who don't want it all around the world, including enslaving some of them. You know, those are what good, upstanding citizens did just a couple of hundred years ago. And it now, you know, at least the sort of progressive worldview in which I'm immersed here sees things completely differently. So what would it mean to continue to be a good person over those time spans?
Indeed. Well, let's take that short break and we'll get back to our conversation with philosopher Stephen Cave. We're talking about some heady stuff, immortality, mortality, death, and a good life. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the fact that the average human lifespan has grown dramatically over the last century. But how long is too long? Would you want to live forever? Our guest is philosopher Stephen Cave, and we've been talking about how living with our mortality has shaped our human existence, and also the dream, the possibility of immortality has also shaped who we are. And again, he's a professor at Cambridge University, wrote a couple of books, Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization. Also co-author of a book called Should You Choose to Live Forever? Let me pick on some, you know, we're talking about death. So I've been thinking about death a lot in preparation for the show. And I was thinking about soldiers and first responders. I mean, these are people who are trained to defy death, to risk their lives for something or someone else. Also thinking about these for lack of a better word, good Samaritans. I mean, people that might see a house on fire in their neighborhood, and they see a screaming mother and child, and they go into the burning building to try to save who is inside. So it's so interesting to see that while we want to live forever, there are moments when, or circumstances when people truly risk their lives and maybe even don't think about living or dying.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there are a few things that might be going on and going on in differently in different people. The first is, I think particularly young people struggle to really internalize the fact of mortality. And so it's a well-known phenomenon among soldiers, particularly young soldiers, that you never really think the next bullet's for you.
Right.
You know, you think it'll be your comrades dying around you. So there is an element of denial or not fully internalizing. And there's some evidence that people do become more risk averse as they get older, and it's because they, you know, realize the truth of human frailty. But there's more than that. There are people who do know what they're doing, I think, and understand the risks they're taking and take them anyway. And some of that can happen because of a narrative that they believe in, that they're somehow part of something bigger than themselves, which will live on. And of course, many cultures in human history have fostered these kinds of narratives. And, you know, the idea that we are, you know, only secondarily individuals and primarily part of a tribe or a people is a very ancient one that is incredibly important. And I think the kind of individualism that is now, you know, fundamental to, you know, the US where you are, Marty, and the UK where I am, is a very new philosophy. And even now, there are movements that, you know, strive instead to emphasize our, you know, belonging to a people or a nation, and encourage a sense that we should be making sacrifices for that people, and we shouldn't worry about death because that people will live on.
I mean, that's interesting to see how individualism versus a sort of collective spirit or experience creates such a different worldview and a different experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some philosophers and psychologists see this as a kind of fundamental tension that is played out differently in all different societies. On the one hand, we all have some instinct to assert ourselves as individuals, but at the same time, we are deeply social beings and feel very, you know, alienating and terrifying to be exposed as an individual. And the extent to which one or other is emphasized varies across cultures. So we talked a bit about Achilles earlier, and, you know, ancient Greece, classical Greece, had a cult of the hero that was all about the individual. And life is then pretty crappy if you're not a great king or a great warrior, because you're one of the anonymous masses, you know, the dark sky against which these stars get to stand out. And you could say our current celebrity culture is a lot like that. But many other cultures have much more emphasized the importance of the collective.
Well, let me pick up on, and this is a very small subset of our country or even of the world, people that are working really hard to extend their own life. They tend to be fabulously wealthy. They don't all live in Silicon Valley, but a lot of them do. And this whole sort of quest for life extension really exacerbates this gulf between, you know, these haves who have what feels like everything, and so many people that have so little. How do you see that?
Yeah. So, you know, we've mentioned the quest to find some kind of elixir to defeat death is an ancient one. But throughout history, it's usually been one that's the preserve of the rich and powerful.
Right.
Because, you know, it's clear, you look around, people aren't living forever. So it requires some kind of profound transformation, and that needs resources. So, you know, the first emperor of China is famous, this is about 2,000 years ago, famous for unifying the country and using all of the resources of this massive country just in order to find some kind of elixir of life. And he, you know, his elixir of life ended up killing him because it had arsenic and mercury in it and so on. but, you know, it is the kings and today the billionaires and so on who have these resources. And a lot of that's, of course, concentrated in Silicon Valley. And it's combined in Silicon Valley with a kind of can-do attitude, you know, with a very utopian attitude that has produced lots of, you know, fantastic innovation and so on. And if you can transform the world with the computer revolution and internet revolution and AI revolution, then you think, well, why can't I transform my body? We can have a biotech revolution. And
I ran across a guy, Brian Johnson. I don't know if you know who that you're nodding.
Yes.
And this is actually from a Time magazine article about him from 2023, so a couple of years old. I'll just read a couple of sentences. And he wants to extend his life. And has a system, I won't go into all the details, but the description is this. That system includes downing 111 pills every day, wearing a baseball cap that shoots red light into his scalp, collecting his own stool samples, and sleeping with a tiny jetpack attached to his penis to monitor his nighttime erections. There's more. Johnson thinks that any act that accelerates aging, like eating a cookie or getting less than 8 hours of sleep, as a, quote, act of violence. Now, you could say, is that living? I don't know. But, I mean, talk about going to extremes to try to extend your life. And what is that life? I mean, it's his life. It's not mine. But holy moly.
Well, you know, Brian is part of a long and, you know, at times noble, at times ignoble tradition of people who, you know, thought they could live forever if they spent 40 years living at the top of a pole in the desert.
Right.
You know, others who grafted monkey testicles onto their own and so on. You know, Brian is very committed to science. I mean, of course, the people I just mentioned were very committed to their own worldviews. You know, it's clear that this gives Brian a lot of meaning. So I'm not, you know, like, there are critics who are like, this life looks terrible. Well, I mean, Brian seems to be enjoying himself.
Yeah.
You know, it's possible that by, you know, pioneering some of these interventions and drawing attention to what is possible with modern technology, that, you know, he will help bring about certain breakthroughs. You know, will Brian live forever? No, sadly he won't.
Right.
Like every other person who sought the elixir of life, he'll one day end up 6 foot under. But I don't think at the moment he's, you know, a force for ill. You know, drawing attention to the possibility of current, you know, medical science is likely to produce some fruit.
It's interesting, though, to think of extending life and at the same time destroying the planet that we're living on.
Yeah.
I mean, that we have this sort of weird collision course of, and I'm not making fun or making light of what Brian Johnson is doing, but this notion of living forever is intriguing. But at the same time, I mean, look at what we're doing to the planet, and will the planet be here? If will the planet support us if we were to live forever?
I agree completely. And, you know, because I go around saying I think immortality is unlikely to be real and, you know, is a false promise and maybe not all it's cracked up to be, people might think, well, you know, I'm happy with 70 or 80 years. And that's not necessarily the case. If you love life, not in which I do, and I, you know, I hope billions of others do, then more of it could well be good. But what does it take to make it go well? Yes, it takes, you know, technological breakthroughs, medical breakthroughs of the kind that, you know, Brian Johnson and others are advocating for. But it also requires thinking about how we tackle systemic injustice, how we tackle the impact of human population and, you know,
and climate
biodiversity
change,
collapse, climate change, etc. So, you know, it's all power to those who are driving the biomedical revolution. But let's also think about how we're going to make that go well in human and environmental terms. And that's a huge job.
Al, our engineer, who you talked to before doing the show, whispered in my ear, you know, I'm not afraid of death, but I'm afraid of dying, which is, and I think a lot of people can relate to that. I mean, death just feels very abstract, but dying feels more real. Can you speak to that tension, I guess?
Sure. Yeah, it's very understandable. Of course, the end of life is usually associated with decline in one's faculties and painful illness and debility and increasing dependence and all of these things, which, of course, impact quality of life enormously. I think the real good news is that we do have interventions that could make it a lot less bad. I mean, the Holy Grail, which real optimists hope for, is so-called compression of morbidity. That means you're compressing the time of real ill health. So, you know, we're healthy for 100 years, then suddenly we drop dead.
Right.
No one knows if that's realistic, because it's not the reality of aging at the moment, where, you know, lives are getting a bit longer, but the proportion we spend in ill health is staying the same, which means as we live longer, we spend a bit longer in ill health. So that's the reality. And it's understandable people are anxious about that. But, you know, we do have, as societies, the resources to support people in those final years to make it a lot less fearful.
And yet I think what people, broadly speaking, fear is being in pain and being alone or lonely. I mean, maybe not at that moment of death. Mm. It's great to have people there, but just knowing that you're not, that you were loved and you're not alone in the world. That there is some comfort there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we mentioned earlier that, you know, meaning in life is not evenly distributed in the population. And, you know, actually, women tend to outlive their partners. So there are lots of single older women. And in statistically, the unhappiest people in the world are poorer older women in wealthy countries.
Wait, let me stop. Poorer older women in wealthy
countries. Poorer older women in wealthy countries.
Got it.
Because they're the most isolated.
Right.
They're the most isolated. And, you know, of course, we've talked a bit about individualism. And, you know, of course, there are many wonders of the civilizations that we enjoy. But atomization of society, there's much less community now than there used to be. That people are expected to, look after themselves, which, you know, of course, if you're 80 and sick in 100 different ways, it is very difficult. So, you know, this individualism and atomization has come at a great cost. And there are lots of ways in which modern life, while it's extending our lifespans, is undermining our ability to be happy.
I mean, I would think sadness or even tragedy would be coming to death and realizing that you didn't really live the life you wanted to live. And I think that that's true for, I mean, no one gets to live perfectly, but to feel as if you came up short or there were so many adversities that you really just could not live the life or maybe be the person that you wanted to be.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think as a society, that means making sure people have opportunities.
Right.
But as individuals, it means accepting the truth of mortality. Because that is what allows us to really value every moment that we have. I think, you know, there is a kind of, there's a you know, YOLO movement. You only live once. I think that's great. We need to embrace the reality of only living once. We need to, well, you might think of it as living each day so that you wouldn't regret it if it was your last, but also not regret it if it isn't. So, you know, quit the job you hate, but don't punch your boss on the way out. Right?
Yes.
Like, it might be your last, but it might not. But a lot of people just assume that it won't be. But one day will be. And I think we need to live every day as if it might be, in order to really understand how precious every minute is.
How important is gratitude?
I think it's so important. I mean, the fear of death, like so much anxiety, is based on worry about losing what we have. We spend so much time hankering for more. And there's masses of evidence that actually we would be a lot happier if we were grateful for what we've got. And most existentially, we should be grateful for the fact that we get to live at all. Hmm. Now, if you think of all of the billions of ridiculously unlikely coincidences that were required to bring about each and every one of us as individuals, you know, our parents meeting and their parents and their parents and their parents, going back to when we were, you know, bacteria in the ocean. It's so unlikely that any one of us gets a chance to live that the idea we spend the entire time complaining that we don't get to live long enough just seems, you know, a little bit ungrateful. And so we ought to treat every moment as a wonder. And, you know, the good thing, and this has, of course, been part of every wisdom tradition, you know, in Christianity, people, you know, have prayers of gratitude, thankfulness to God, etc., but also, you know, New Age spiritualism. Like so many wisdom traditions emphasize gratitude. You know, we talked about ancient Rome earlier, Stoicism, Epicureanism, they all emphasize gratitude. And now psychology also has come in to show so much evidence that actually being grateful for the lives we have, no matter how long they are, will allow us to make the best of them.
Stephen Cave, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today on The Connection. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, Stephen Cave is a philosophy professor at Cambridge University. He's also author of several books, Immortality, The Quest to Live Forever and How It Drives Civilization, and one he co-authored titled Should You Choose to Live Forever? And that's it for today's edition of The Connection. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram, find us on Facebook, and sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection, the show produced by Debbie Bilder with Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.